Oz. Well, here he is, a wizard of whiz, if ever a whiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a whiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the Land of Oz. This is part 17 of the Wizards of Money series, and it is entitled Caught Between a Dock and a Sweatshop. As the holiday season of 2002 approaches, this 17th edition of the Wizards of Money will look at the path taken by the goodies that will end up under the Christmas tree this year. We will start with the following analysis of Santa's business model. Although nobody really wants to tell their kids this, Santa does not start his journey at the North Pole in December. He starts in China in about June. The majority of the elves making the holiday gifts are migrants from rural China who Santa lures to the factory cities by the millions. And despite its mythical appeal, Santa knows that carrying all this cargo by air is not economically feasible, so the flying reindeer carrying the presents are really giant ships crossing the Pacific Ocean. The ships get unloaded by the tallest breed of elves, who, much to Santa's irritation, use their height to make demands on Santa. Once Santa gets past that barrier and the goods are trucked inland, they end up getting stocked to the shelves by some of the lowest paid elves in this land of holiday cheer. Since Santa is too fat to squeeze down the chimney, he instead offers credit to tempt people into the stores to get the goodies themselves. Finally, all this credit, plus a bit more, goes back to Santa in his home at the heart of the capital markets. This snapshot of Santa's business model provides a glimpse of some of the primary battles being waged today in the ages-old war between labour and capital. This episode of The Wizards of Money will focus on the following three contemporary battle zones along Santa's journey. The first being Chinese toy factories, second, the US Pacific Coast docks, and third, the giant retailer, Walmart. The labourers in these three regions of Santa's journey, the start, the middle and the end, sit at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of securing a reasonable share of the fruits of their labour. The labourers at the start and the end of the journey, travelled by internationally traded goods, have almost no power to bargain with their employers and consequently are not getting their fair share. The start of the journey is the manufacturing end, which is made up primarily of factories in China and other developing nations. The end of the journey is the US retail stores, increasingly dominated by the biggest retail giant in history, Walmart, of course. And in the middle of the journey sit the Pacific Coast longshoremen, some of the highest paid labourers today, thanks to the gains made by the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or ILWU, over several decades. Given the triumph of capital over labour at the retail and manufacturing endpoints of Santa's journey, it's hardly surprising to see the forces of capital now pulling out all stops to bring this middle point into line. To start this Wizards of Money holiday special, we're going to start with a toy story. Millions of us have to go through the painful process of shopping for holiday gifts for kids around this time of year. Last week I went to Walmart to buy some cheap little trinkets that will delight my nieces and nephews. One toy was a Matchbox SUV. This cost only $1.47. Another toy was a Bob the Builder ball, since that's a favourite of one of my nephews. The Bob the Builder ball was more pricey than the Matchbox SUV at $1.76. And finally, the most expensive item of all, a fancy little Barbie outfit for one of my nieces at $1.84. In all, it cost me $5.07 before tax to complete my holiday shopping for my two nephews and one niece. But that's not all they'll be getting. You see, when me and my purchases got home, I couldn't shut them up. Busting to share their experiences, but too afraid to talk in the Walmart store, they gave a detailed account of their long journey from China, across the Pacific Ocean, and into the Walmart shelves. They told me of the things they saw along the way, while some companies thought no one was looking. First, the Barbie dress burst into tears when she recalled the conditions in the factory in China where she was made. She said that most of the ladies there would never be able to afford something as fancy as she. And yet, they were working non-stop with hardly any days off since the busy season started in about June. One young lady in a factory nearby was literally worked to death, and the Barbie dress reminded me that this incident was covered in the US press in the Washington Post on May 13th of this year. The Bob the Builder ball, a young ball with a keen interest in unions, said that while he was being stitched up, he tried to find out something about attempts to organise unions in China. But there was certainly no talk on the job in those factories, so he waited till he saw something in the news when he got to the US about how China's ruling Communist Party had just ordered the extinction of something that was starting to look like an independent labour union. Apparently, the only official unions in China that are allowed are operated by the party-run All Trade Federation of Trade Unions. And, Bob added, very disappointed, this government union is about as corrupt as it can be. Pretty soon, the Matchbox SUV chimed in and stated that both he and the Barbie dress were Mattel products and that I could find the consumer information number on their backs. He urged me to call Mattel at this number to ask them some questions about their factories in China. So I did just this. However, when you call the Mattel consumer information number, where you're supposed to be able to ask any question whatsoever about a Mattel product you bought, there is apparently one question you can't ask. And that's about the conditions under which these products were made. In no time at all, I was whisked over to the Mattel Public Relations Department and got to speak with the Public Relations Vice President. The dress suspected it was Barbie herself, but I wasn't quite sure. Anyway, she was extremely nice and assured me that all the information I needed was on the Mattel website. So me, the Barbie dress and the Matchbox SUV hopped onto the internet and looked up Mattel's website. We soon found out that the Barbie vice president at Mattel had told us a bit of a fib. The only information on the Mattel site about its operations in China were 2 years outdated. And also there was no information about how its so-called independent monitoring team was selected or compensated. We wanted to know these things and also wanted more up-to-date information about the factories. So we spoke again to the Barbie VP. She said she would investigate the matter and then get back to us. But to this day, she still hasn't called back, and the poor little Barbie dress sits by the phone in silence with a forlorn look like she's been betrayed by one of her heroes. The toys later told me that their trip across the sea was pretty humdrum, since they were stuffed in containers in the dark. But when they got to the docks on the west coast of the US, all hell had broken loose. There they bobbed up and down for 10 days without moving, because the shipping companies had locked out the dock workers. After this long delay, the Bob the Builder ball managed to roll himself out of the container long enough to ask a dock worker what was going on. He heard about their concerns that their union might be under the attack of some very powerful business interests and some very crafty PR people who actually made it seem like the workers had been on strike, when what had happened is that they'd actually been locked out or prevented from going to work. Finally, the toys made it to my local Walmart store. After hearing all this stuff about freedom and democracy in the wonderland of America, boy, were they disappointed when they saw what kind of lives some of the Walmart workers had. And, after being in China for so long, they certainly recognized propaganda when they saw it. I later told the toys that I couldn't believe they were so cheap. Altogether, they only cost me $5.07. But then I realized that was not a very nice thing to say, even to a toy. So I didn't discuss their cost with them anymore. Instead, later that week, I got some clarification of why they were so cheap from Bill Meyer at the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Las Vegas, the epicenter of labor organizing for Walmart.
At the end of the day, somebody's paying for these low prices, whether it's a poor person in Guatemala or a prisoner in Red China or the workers themselves at Walmart. You may save a quarter on a tube of toothpaste, but somebody's suffering as a result of that, and that's the information we have to get out to the public.
We'll hear more of this interview later on, along with an interview I did with Mike Leonard at UFCW in Washington, D.C., who's heading up the national Walmart campaign. But first of all, the little toys asked me to do a little history lesson on labor issues. So I thought I'd start at a point in time a few thousand years ago.
Rome will not allow us to escape from Italy. We have no choice but to march against Rome herself and end this war the only way it could have ended, by freeing every slave in Italy. I promise you a new Rome, a new Italy, and a new empire. I promise the destruction of the slave army and the restoration of order throughout all our territories. I'd rather be here, a free man among brothers, facing a long march and a hard fight, than to be the richest citizen of Rome, fat with food he didn't work for, and surrounded by slaves.
Big Capital has been using two primary weapons against organized labor consistently for thousands of years, namely propaganda and intimidation. The third, physical force, fell out of favor in the 20th century as the other two became increasingly effective and as the excesses of physical force sometimes led to too much sympathy for labor and thereby undermined the propaganda efforts. In the lands where electronic communications media are pervasive, this third arm of capital's army is barely needed anymore. Modern capital learned many lessons from the leaders of the great Roman Empire, built largely upon the complete submission of labor. While Rome did not have unions to contend with, there arose the occasional force that Rome feared most on the home front: solidarity of the slaves, spearheaded by the rare charismatic leader. The most famous slave organizer of Roman times was, of course, Spartacus. Rome went to great trouble to use all these strategies to deal with the organized slave problem.
Did you truly believe 500 years of Rome could so easily be delivered into the clutches of a mob?
Already, the bodies of 6,000 crucified slaves line the Appian Way. Tomorrow, the last of their companions will fight to the death in the temple of my fathers as a sacrifice to them. As those slaves have died, so will your rabble, if they falter one instant in loyalty to the new order of affairs. The enemies of the state are known. Arrests are in progress. The prisons begin to fill. In every city and province, lists of the disloyal have been compiled. Tomorrow they will learn the cost of their terrible folly, their treason.
And where does my name appear on the list of disloyal enemies of the state?
First.
For intimidation purposes, the crucifixion of thousands of slaves from the Spartacus army along the Appian Way leading into Rome was remarkably effective. But even following the death of Spartacus, Rome still had something of a Spartacus problem on its hands. After all, they didn't want slaves or cheap labour to get ideas about organising, or to get high hopes that they actually could achieve a better life. For this reason, Rome most probably went to a lot of trouble to eliminate the legend of Spartacus. So too it would seem for the great labour organisers that would emerge in the 20th century under the American Empire. One of these was the Australian-born Pacific Coast longshoreman, Harry Bridges, who was to have a profound influence on the improvement of labour conditions for American workers, and whose union was to be one of the pioneers in getting benefits like healthcare and pensions for workers. Yet how many people have ever even heard of him? Yes, Harry caused something of a modern-day Spartacus problem. The first president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Bridges was one of the 20th century's most effective labour leaders, a key figure in the general strike of 1934 and in the lead-up to the breakthrough National Labour Relations, or WLRR Act, of 1935. His work in the ILWU and other organising bodies inspired a lot of workers to fight for a better life. Naturally, work began almost immediately to tarnish his name. Bridges was to suffer constant attacks and many attempts at deportation, leading up to and during the McCarthy era. And today, in line with the general decline of union power, his legend lives on only in the margins. Furthermore, many of the gains in getting benefits for workers pioneered by his union are now either not available for non-union sectors or becoming a thing of the past. In order to understand the contemporary dispute on the Pacific Coast docks that President Bush recently stepped into and its significance well beyond these docks, we first go back in time to the days of the Great Depression. In our trip back in time, we will hear some excerpts from a documentary called From Wharf Rats to Lords of the Docks, a radio documentary produced by the Harry Bridges Project and Public Radio International about the life of Harry Bridges. A link to this show will be placed on the Wizards of Money website at wizardsofmoney.org. The Pacific Coast docks that my little toys from China got unloaded on was certainly a tough place to work at the start of the 1930s. Not only was pay lousy and the hours long, but the safety precautions in place were dismal. To make matters worse, the way that workers got work was mostly through a system of favouritism by the employers based on bribes and kickbacks. Men who hadn't participated in this corrupt process may stand in line for hours a day for days on end and not get any work. And certainly, anyone known to be an organiser or have an interest in unions could easily be passed over for work. In that time at the start of the Great Depression, the shippers had all the power and the dock workers had none. Fed up with the situation and to put pressure on their employers for a fairer slice of the shippers' profits, the dock workers up and down the Pacific Coast, along with many other maritime workers, went on strike in 1934. Harry Bridges, a dock worker in his early 30s, was appointed chairman of the Joint Strike Committee of Maritime Workers. A turning point in this strike came a day after Independence Day of 1934, when two striking longshoremen were killed by the San Francisco police. After their deaths and a solemn funeral procession in San Francisco, including tens of thousands of people across the city, public sympathy swayed towards the longshoremen. Not too long afterwards, this evolved into a general strike in San Francisco, with many other unions showing their solidarity with the longshoremen and also going on strike. Bringing commerce in this city to a screeching halt certainly put the national spotlight on the longshoremen's issues. Armed with the support of the public and the other unions, the longshoremen had bargaining power and were finally able to negotiate a contract that included better pay and more reasonable hours. Very importantly, it also included some control over the hiring process so that employers couldn't just pick and choose employees based on their corrupt selection process. Later, the dock workers would form a new union called the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or ILWU, with Harry Bridges as its first president. The mid-1930s, in the midst of the Great Depression, was a time when the power of capital was greatly weakened and a chance for labour to make gains. And so it did. The victory of the longshoremen and other maritime workers in the general strike of 1934 was one example. But perhaps the most significant national victory of that time was the passage of the landmark National Labour Relations Act, also known as the Wagner Act of 1935. The Wagner Act, the original National Labour Relations Act, or NLRA, for the first time guaranteed employees the right to self-organisation. It guaranteed them the right to form, join or assist labour organisations, to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing, and to engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid and protection. To implement and uphold these rights, the Act created the National Labour Relations Board, or NLRB. Before the enactment of the NLRA, the federal government had refrained almost entirely from supporting collective bargaining over wages and working conditions and from facilitating the growth of trade unions. This act facilitated the growth in trade unions and union membership over the next 2 decades, which peaked sometime in the 1950s. But never one to sit idly by and watch its power be weakened, the forces of capital and big business set to work the day the Wagner Act came into force to dismantle the power of unions. The old tricks of propaganda and intimidation were back in full force, and capital was back to full strength by the end of World War II. And so the Taft-Hartley Act, an amendment to the National Labour Relations Act in favour of big business, was passed in 1947, even over the objections of President Truman. At this point, the anti-union propaganda and activities of business of the past few decades culminated in the frightening full-blown McCarthy era. For decades, successful union leaders like Harry Bridges, who represented the best interests of their rank-and-file members, were constantly under surveillance and investigation, harassed, intimidated, and of course, called communists. Harry also faced constant attempts to deport him back to Australia. Nevertheless, through all this, Harry and the ILWU continued their work on behalf of the rank-and-file longshoremen, and today they are some of the most well-compensated union workers. According to the documentary From Wharf Rats to Lords of the Docks, Harry and the ILWU pioneered the establishment of employer-sponsored benefits such as health care, dental care, pensions and paid vacations.
When he met with the employers, he told them what we're after. He says, the longshoremen worked through the war and loaded your ships and made you millionaires, and now we're going after some of that money. We may not get it now, but we're going to get it. We want health and welfare programs, pension programs, dental care, eye care, everything. And the employers walked out of the meeting. And then they come back about an hour later and said, we can't agree to any of this. And he says, besides that, while you're here, you might as well mark it down. We want a huge raise. This man was for education, he was for health care, he talked about vacations, and you said, this man must be dreaming, I'm sure I never had any vacation.
I can remember Dad telling me when Bridges said, our goal is eye care, health care, dental care for our families. He said, Bridges is nuts.
But he wasn't. The union pioneered benefits, holidays, paid holidays, pensions, and health and dental care.
Finally, as the McCarthy era was coming to a close, and after more than 20 years of constant harassment, Harry became a US citizen and the constant attempts to deport him came to a halt. Let's hear from Harry Bridges.
Harry Bridges.
For the first time, or one of the first times in many years, I happen to be speaking on a platform tonight where I'm not under indictment or charges of deportation or... We need something in this labor movement that seems to have been lost, or mislaid, or destroyed, or sold out. And that's a very simple, old-fashioned word called solidarity or unity. That's what we need.
Apart from its tools of propaganda, intimidation, and the constant whittling down of the effectiveness of the National Labor Relations Act, organized capital still had two more powerful weapons up its sleeve. And these are the ones that organized labor still has no counteroffensive for. These weapons are 1, technology, and 2, overseas labor. By the nature of its work, the ILWU never really faced the threat of moving jobs overseas to any great extent. But it has faced the technology issue on 2 major occasions. The first was in the 1950s when containerization technology entered shipping, culminating in the 1960 mechanization and modernization agreement between the shippers and the dock workers. The ILWU dealt with this entry of technology by acknowledging that the number of available jobs would decrease with the implementation of technology, but also by ensuring that new technology jobs would remain in the union and that workers who would be retired would receive reasonable benefits. In general, pay and benefits for workers were increased. In this way, the current generation of workers shared in the gains made through the implementation of technology, but they also pass on less union jobs to the next generation.
Now, realistically, the machines are here and they're here to stay. Machines make easy work. They're a part of giving us our high standard of living, the highest in the world. So we'd like to be in a position to welcome the machine. It's just a simple question of what share should the worker get out of the savings or the profits of the machine?
Harry was tense at all times during those negotiations because he was trying to tell the rank and file, this is the only way to go.
The second major time the ILWU has faced the technology issue is right now, with the implementation of technology to make the labelling and identification of cargo more efficient. Only now, organized labor has been under such fierce attack for so many years that the general power of unions is much weakened. Union membership is now at about the same level it was at in the roaring 1920s that we spoke a lot about in Wizards Part 10. Now it is harder even for the historically stronger unions such as the ILWU to bargain with employers. And, as we shall see when we get to the Walmart issue, the National Labor Relations Act has become something of a joke in terms of protecting the workers' right to organize and bargain collectively. It would seem that the ILWU would have liked to resolve the contemporary technology issue using a compromise similar to the Mechanization and Modernization, or M&M Agreement, as it is known, of 1960. But the shippers don't seem to want to come to such a compromise. regardless of the claims on either side about what led to the closing of the docks in October this year and the cargo stranded at the ports for 10 days, there are two things that seem clear. First, it was the Pacific Maritime Association, the Association of Employers, who instigated the lockout. It was not a strike. However, it sometimes seems that this is how the media portrays it. And indeed, many people that I speak to seem to think that this is what happened. And second, the ILWU appeared to have no intention of striking. Now, the business press claims that the ILWU might adopt a work slowdown rather than strike because their compensation is already so high that they would not win public support in a strike, and that this slowdown is what forced the Employers Association to lock them out. However, the union claims that the PMA, that is, the shippers, possibly with the help of the big retailers like Walmart, who import all their Asian-made goods through the West Coast ports, are trying to weaken or bust the union. Both arguments have merit. It is the argument of the union that I find worthy of much attention. For if it is true, then the implications are profound. It will be very interesting to see what happens next. Will the ILWU, for decades one of the leading trendsetters in establishing gains for workers, come out of this process significantly weakened? And how much do the big retailers, who import an increasing amount of their manufactured goods from the newest member of the World Trade Organization through these docks, have to do with all this? A weakening of the ILWU would certainly deal a huge blow to the labour movement at a time when it is battling the trend of the big retailers at home to lower standards in the ever-growing retail sector. On that note, let's now take a good look at the biggest one of these retailers, Walmart. On Thursday, November 14th, 2002, the front page of the Wall Street Journal greeted readers with the cheery news that Walmart's third quarter earnings had been reported and that profits were up 23%. I decided it was time for a chat with Mike Glennard, who heads up the National Walmart Campaign for the United Food and Commercial Workers, UFCW.
I'm Michael Leonard, and I'm Executive Vice President of United Food and Commercial Workers International Union. We're a union with 1.4 million working men and women in retail and grocery and healthcare and other fields. And I'm also the Director of Strategic Campaigns for UFCW, which means that the department that I head up oversees projects and campaigns of industry-wide, our nationwide, North America-wide, actually, impact to our members, which for right now means Walmart. Well, you know, Walmart is now the nation's largest employer and arguably the largest supermarket operator in the country, the world's largest employer also. They had sales last year of about $220 billion. The way I really got involved in it was as they came into the grocery industry. Many of their employees knew about a union for grocery workers, and they began to contact us, and they found, you know, to be quite a difference between what Walmart pays and what Walmart claims to deliver in terms of benefits and what was available through the union. So really for the first time since the passing of Sam Walton, I think Sam Walton was a retail genius. But after his passing, you know, this company became totally bottom line driven, and that also carries into the way they deal with their employees.
Well, can you talk about the legacy of Sam Walton?
Sam Walton was a genuine thing. And like I said, I believe he's not only a retail genius, but he actually valued his employees. And you know, people who came up with Sam when he was building this company really shared in its success. And that's not to say that everybody became a millionaire, and not everyone should or can today. But he was fair in the way that he compensated people, and he was, you know, everybody got a fair shake. He had policies that he meant that were there to protect the people. He had an open door policy that where they really could come in and talk to the management. They could actually get a fair shake, or they could call him at home. And he just stood for, a lot of good things that no longer, the company has changed so much, it's gotten so vast, it's gotten so large, that growth is, they maintain the impression of the culture that Sam created, but they've basically deserted it, and they've left the employees behind in doing it.
Well, can you talk, just to give some historical background for unions that have been established in other, competitors of Walmart, like Kroger's and so forth.
Yeah, well, I worked for a Kroger company. I started working for the Kroger company in 1964. They were organized back in the 40s. A&P was organized back in the 40s.
So these are very old unions.
Right, these are companies that went through a period of rapid growth and prominence and leadership in the industry, and they did it while they were paying their people the best wages in the industry, and providing real pensions, and providing health care to the employees, and often to their dependents at no cost to the employee. About 2/3 of the Walmart employees aren't getting any kind of employer health care. They either don't qualify for it or they can't afford it. And that, historically, in the grocery industry, employers have provided that. And Walmart wants to change that, that they want to gut that feature of what has been the employer-employee pact for the unionized industry, because Walmart is the number one company in the country in size and profitability and growth. You have a downward pressure now.
What's the average hourly wage?
The average hourly wage that we have, and we've received this through any number of surveys, not just our own, the average hourly wage is $7.50. Walmart considers 28 hours a week full-time.
That's what you need to qualify for health care, 28 hours?
That and a period of employment.
I know that the majority of Walmart employees are female. Mm-hmm. Let's say for a single mother with a couple of kids, who is working 30 hours a week, and how would they get health care? Like, first of all, how much?
They would have to work enough hours. They would have to stay there long enough to be able to enroll. And then they would have to pay out of their pocket monthly, depending on the number of people covered, anywhere from $200 to $300 a month.
That's a month.
Right, on a wage that's $7.50 an hour or less.
Would they otherwise qualify for Medicaid or anything like that?
Well, it's surprising that you ask that. I know of at least one state where the management of some stores was directing people who couldn't afford the contribution out of their own paycheck. The standing procedure in a store was to tell the people how to get their children covered by CHIPS, by the government program for children. So you have this immensely profitable company who comes into a community, builds a store, gets every tax break they can get, guts the community's small businesses, reduces the tax base while they're running everybody else out of business, and then sends its employees, promises good jobs to a community, but sends its employees, who it doesn't provide health care for, off to public assistance. And Walmart has about 800,000 U.S. employees. 2/3 of them don't have health care.
Can you talk about how your national organizing is going?
We have probably 24 other active campaigns, all at different levels. One of the things, we went to Las Vegas because it was a good place for us to begin, to draw a line in the sand, to protect the industry and the jobs of our members, and to raise the Walmart workers up. And we learned a lot about the company out there. And one of the things that we learned is that every place a union campaign starts, you can basically expect that Walmart will violate the law. So we have to go through quite a process.
Meaning the labor law, the National
Right, the National Labor Relations Act. And they've done it over and over and over. They were just in Alaska this week. They got a judge ordered them to pay back pay and put another worker back to work. And, we filed 44 charges against them in Las Vegas. Judge ruled in our favor on 40 of them. Walmart always calls these things insignificant and unimportant. It's a federal law. I don't know of any federal law that you can thumb your nose at unless you're a corporation the size of Walmart. I mean, these are workers' rights. When the government issues a ruling, they don't issue a ruling on behalf of the union. They issue a ruling on behalf of the worker. And so what we've had to do is every place we've done these campaigns or are doing these campaigns, we basically do them under Walmart's nose until we get strong enough, because we know how they'll react. They will break the law. And so the people have to be know that, and we have to have the infrastructure there to support them and intend to be there and sustain a long-term fight, because this is going to be a long fight.
I was wondering if you can talk also about, you know, if you walk into Walmart store, you'll find that most of the goods are made in China and other places.
You know, that some of that the issues is, it's true about Walmart, and there have been so many stories linked to Walmart because they're the largest importer of consumer goods from China. But and as bad as that is, you know, and you have all those stories about sweatshops, child labor, and different things. But I will say that they just do more of it than anyone else. I mean, there are many other retailers who also buy from those same type manufacturers. The difference, what I believe the real difference is, and what I accuse Walmart of, is the other employers may buy the goods, but they don't import the attitude towards workers. When Walmart says they bring it home to America, you know, they're not bringing jobs home to America. They're bringing that kind of conduct and behavior of violating workers' rights and violating the laws designed to protect workers. That's what they're bringing home to America. And if we allow that, then workers in these third world nations, you know, who are working for next to nothing, you know, if we allow them to be trampled on while Walmart imports all this stuff and we consume it, if we don't stand up against that, then what hope do those workers have?
And in terms of the union, the anti-union activity, some of the strategies that they employ, I mean, I think it's becoming more widely known about this so-called people division in Bentonville.
People.
Yeah, can you talk about that division, and do other companies have divisions like that, or is that unique to Walmart?
I don't know of another company that tries to characterize it the way Walmart does. I mean, I've been doing this work for 30 years, and you know, union busters and the other side, the company has a right to put out a message and take positions and all. They don't have a right to break the law. And what Walmart's people do is they come in and they create a pressure cooker situation for the people. And they don't leave until the people are scared and intimidated and afraid to have a fair and free election or a voice on the job that, you know, the law says they can have. And they bring these people in, and they keep them there. And they do little one-on-ones with people. Then they put a union supporter with 15 or 20 people who are hostile to the union, members of management, people who, you know, who they've handpicked to harass and harangue them. They target people for retaliation and for, you know, for termination. And we've actually put together a video. We've gone to some of their farmer people who were involved in doing it, who, you know, that was their job at Walmart, and managers and department managers, and we sat them down, they sat right down and told us how they do it and how they were trained to do it. And when that department comes in, their job is to not leave until no one in that store voices an opinion in favor of the union. You know, it's very difficult for workers to organize in this country. All we want it to be is fair. And you know, we're not going to, I think it says a lot about what kind of country we become when there is a law that is such a big joke that corporations can just do what they want to do. But the People's Day of Action is going to change that.
Yeah, can you talk about that?
Yeah, so we put together this National Day of Action, and we've got probably 100 sponsors of national organizations, like the National Organization for Women, A. Philip Randolph Institute, of course, the AFL-CIO, with the Alliance for Retired Americans, American Federation of Teachers, American Federation of State County Municipal Employees, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, Jobs with Justice, the National Farm Worker Ministry, the National Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice with 9 to 5, the National Association of, you know, Working Women, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
So this will be happening on November 21.
Right.
And exactly what will be happening on that day?
Well, at about 140 different locations across the country, which will involve about 140 different media markets, these various groups will come together. Some of them have a code of conduct that they're going to ask Walmart to adhere to. Some of them Others are going to confront Walmart with their record on discrimination, on race or gender or disabilities, and ask them to sign a pledge. All these groups will have their own peaceful demonstration to take to management to try to make this company realize that there's millions of people out here who don't like the way that they're conducting their business.
So will this be taking place outside of Walmart stores?
Right, right.
Oh, it will, okay.
Yeah, and we have a website, www.walmartdayofaction.com.
Recently, I also spoke with Bill Meyer, who heads up the Walmart campaign for UFCW in the current key organizing city of Las Vegas.
My name is Bill Meyer, and I'm I work for the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, which is the largest organization of retail workers represented under agreements in the United States as far as being unionized. We also protect through our contracts certain working conditions and benefits that over a period of time have increase the standard of living of our members so that they have good middle-class lifestyles. Walmart threatens that, and not only here in Las Vegas, but across the country, because they go in with much lower wages and benefits, and the lower community standards, not only for our members, but for the cities and towns in which they enter. And that's the reason why we're trying to organize them, so that they would come up, the workers at Walmart and Sam's Club, come up to the levels that we have in union contracts, not the reverse.
Why Las Vegas in particular?
Las Vegas is a very union-oriented city. It has roots in organized labor. Many of the casinos got started with the help of organized labor. So they have a rich history of union activity here in this town. And there's a lot of favorable sentiment toward unions. So we believed, and looking at this city, and with the activity that we saw in some of the stores, that this would be a good place to start building a foundation for the future.
And can you describe how the organizing is going at the moment? What's the status of it? And what are some recent sort of landmark events that have taken place?
Well, the last landmark event was a major decision by an administrative law judge citing Walmart for many violations of the National Labor Relations Act. The company, no matter where they see activity, Walmart goes in with what we call the People's Department of their company. And what they are, really, it's a nice name for union busters. And they will do just about anything to intimidate, coerce, and stop people to utilize their rights in forming a union. And what they do is have a culture of anti-unionism that begins when an employee starts the very first day at work, and it permeates throughout the management system. They teach, it's almost like a cult, they teach their management people that unions are enemies of the company, that somehow if we had unions, it would destroy the fabric of this company, and it's certainly that is wrong. But because that culture is so strong, even though they say, don't violate National Labor Relations laws, they give a wink and a nod to their management people to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a squad of union busters in their People's Department division, and they have a fleet of 27 private jets that if you mention the word union in Walla Walla, Washington, that next day they'll have a union buster People's Department representative in that store, and that and any store within the United States, they have a group of these People's Department employees that go to try to squash any sort of union movement in any of their...
So they can afford 27 planes, but not... not a wage increase.
That's correct. And recently here in Las Vegas, we had a Sam's Club store that we petitioned the National Labor Relations Board to conduct an election. once that petition was filed, immediately the company packed the unit. In other words, they went on a hiring frenzy, and they hired dozens of new people that they would screen and make sure that they were going to vote the company's way. And they conducted illegal polling and surveillance and intimidation tactics that were so bad that the National Labor Relations Board, after we filed these charges, felt that a free and fair election at that store could not take place. Because really, when workers go into that voting booth, they should be voting whether they want a union or not. And in many cases, Walmart makes the innuendo that you're not voting for a union, you're voting whether to keep your job or not. And, I mean, in a physical sense, it can't compare, but it's almost like the elections that Saddam Hussein had, where they had 100% showing that they support him. In this case, it's a mental terrorism that they use. And I don't use that word lightly. They really do use a systematic approach to terrorize their workers, that if you support a union, somehow drastic things are going to happen to you. Now, obviously, the consequences of voting yes or no are not the same as a country like Iraq. But to those workers, their job's important, because for many of them, they live on a week-to-week basis, and losing a paycheck can mean the difference between homelessness or keeping a roof over their heads. So, yes, they use these tactics, and I really wish the government would really step down on them like they are doing in the Middle East, because those are the kind of tactics that we're seeing, and the government seeing it through the labor board almost on a daily basis.
What about this issue of surveillance cameras? Is that used in stores, or is that something that's hard to prove?
Cameras and also management. All of a sudden, when management never went into the break room with their associates once a union activity takes place, management people all of a sudden start taking their breaks along with them so they can hear what the conversations are.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who just talk about anything that if they suspect they're talking about union, you have one of these management people come in and try to hear what's going on. So, again, you're right. They use a tremendous amount of resources to prevent a union from coming into their workplace, and they, quite frankly, have the money. I mean, when you do an excess on an average basis, and we just did this calculation of over $600 million a day is generated in Walmart stores throughout this country, and that translates into over $220 billion a year. When you have that kind of revenue and are willing to fight the system that we have in this country to such an extent, they're willing to spend that kind of money. And we have heard stories about the fact that when we did have a campaign going here in Las Vegas for the one store where we were going to have an election, the company spent in excess of $3 million in one store in exercising their intimidation practice.
And what would be the cost of them in that one store providing, an increase in the hourly wage? And
it would be far less than that.
Yeah.
I mean, my goodness gracious.
When you say that the National Labor Relations Board has found Walmart in violation of certain labor laws, What does that mean? Obviously, none of their executives are being carried away to jail or anything like that. What is the effect of that?
If that was the case, I would believe that they would stop breaking the law. But violations of the National Labor Relations Act carry very minor penalties and no monetary violations in most cases. And also, the old phrase, delayed is justice denied. And what happens is that the labor board really have great people working for them, but the law has been diluted to such an extent that delay is built into the system. And you could file a charge for violating your rights to organize, but that charge takes time to be investigated. And then you have to go through a trial, which can take up to a year. And then it could be 6, 7, 8 months before the administrative law judge makes up his or her mind. And if you get a favorable decision, most often, Walmart will appeal that to the full National Labor Relations Board in Washington, D.C. That takes a considerable amount of time. And then that decision from the National Labor Relations Board can be appealed to Circuit Court of Appeals, in which the situation occurred. That takes more time. And believe it or not, they have another opportunity to appeal to the United States Supreme Court. So when you're looking at perhaps up to 2, 3, 4 years in order to get these things adjudicated, that certainly doesn't help in organizing that movement, because the people, with the turnover that they have, you know, it's just an incredible amount of delay that, and you have probably only a handful of the people around at the time you started the project.
What is the turnover, annual turnover rate?
The company admits that they have an annual turnover of 70%.
70. Wow.
And we see here in Las Vegas that being much higher, somewhere in the 85 to 90% area.
From a business perspective, it's very expensive to have a high turnover rate because you've got to continually train people. And
well, they've made turnover a science. They use something called computer-based learning. So you don't actually have a worker that trains you. You get in front of a computer terminal and you take some lessons and you're thrown out onto the floor. And the company just uses this computer-based learning. They throw a worker in front of a computer after, of course, they're indoctrinated about not supporting any unions. And every worker who is hired, they see a anti-union film called You Picked a Great Place to Work. And then you're thrown in front of a computer, and then you're thrown out on the sales floor.
How do you get in front of lots of the workers?
We also have a radio show that we do every Tuesday evening. Worker Voice radio program is webcast across the Internet.
Oh, could you give the URL of that?
Internet site for our radio show is at www.klav1230am.com. And we have our Internet site, www.walmartworkerslv.com.
That's all for the Wizards of Money. Please note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org where you can get the text of all episodes and you can get all further references underlying the information in each episode.